Hi, everyone. I think we will start now. Welcome to Me Too and Our Movements at the Socialism 2019 Conference. My name is Elizabeth Wrigley Field. I live in Minneapolis and use she, her pronouns. I feel very honored to be facilitating this session. We're going to run this session in two parts. The first part is going to be a structured conversation between our panelists as they respond to a series of questions. And then after that, we'll open it up so that everyone in the room has an opportunity to participate in the conversation. Before I do anything else, let me introduce the panelists who we are extremely fortunate to have leading off this conversation with us. Mariam Abidi is a socialist organizer, originally from the Midwest, currently based in Los Angeles. She's worked on campaigns against cops and private prisons and Caterpillar contracts, helped to organize tacos for teachers and UTLA solidarity efforts during the strike this January. She formerly served as the co-convener of the ISO's Survivors Caucus and was a member of the crisis leadership team that responded to sexual violence within the organization before its collapse. She is a law student working in public defense, always thinking about what transformative justice means and what non-state and anti-state responses to harm might look like. So welcome, Mariam. Anne Russo teaches in women's and gender studies at DePaul University. Her work focuses on queer, anti-racist, and feminist movement building. Her most recent book, Feminist Accountability, Disrupting Violence and Transforming Power, explores transformative justice, prison abolition, and community accountability responses to violence that cultivate communal healing, intervention, accountability, and transformation. We have many copies available in the Haymarket Room. I personally found it a very helpful book, and I encourage you all to check it out. Welcome, Anne. And Kate Doyle Griffiths is a member of Red Bloom and an affiliate of the Marxist Center. You may have seen them at other sessions about the Marxist Center this weekend. They write on feminism and Marxism for Verso, Viewpoint, and The Nation. And I have found them to be a productive and very thought-provoking collaborator on these questions for many years. Please welcome Kate. Before I pose my first question to the panel, I have a couple of announcements and some context. The first announcement is just that there have been some changes to the schedule, so you're best off checking the one online, which is up to date and correct. The second announcement is that the material in this session is very personal for many of us, and we want everyone to have a good experience. Of course, anyone who feels like they should step out of the room should feel absolutely free to do that. It's not rude in any way. We also have a trauma-informed healthcare provider on call for individuals throughout the conference who are in acute crisis or experiencing trauma. And they are here in this room. So if you want to step out and have support as you do, signal to Mary, who's standing in the back waving, and they will be happy to accompany you. Mary is also leading a healing meditation for survivors today, tomorrow, as they have been the last couple of days. I've got handouts at the front explaining more about what that's about, which you can get after the session if you're interested. It will be tomorrow, Sunday, from 1:15 to 1:45 in room Hyde Park B. Finally, the context I wanted to provide is just to bring everyone in the room into some of the conversations that we had as we were preparing this panel. So the insights that our panelists bring to this discussion are informed by their own organizing histories. And so one question that everyone had to grapple with is what kind of detail to share. We want to have a conversation that's concrete enough that we get into the real issues that we on the left need to address about violence and sexism in our movements, instead of staying at a level of generality where everyone agrees but disguises the real dilemmas. but sometimes the experiences someone has learned the most from is not their own, right? So we want to respect other people's ownership of their own stories. And we also don't want to distract from the lessons that we're trying to get into by having people sitting here trying to figure out, like, oh, which person exactly was that story about? Or by focusing on the idiosyncrasies of particular organizations in cases where what we're talking about are really ubiquitous issues on the left, right? But nor do we want to soften organizational failures. So these are some of the tensions that our panelists were navigating. And the reason I'm sharing all of this with you to start us out is just so that everyone knows that the panelists have put a lot of thought into what they want to say, and also that nobody thinks that their own answers to those dilemmas are ideal. Right, because we felt that actually there were no ideal answers. So we all thought that it was a fitting way to begin this session, just to bring the audience into some of that complexity, so that we all have to grapple with as a left, right, to figure out how to have these discussions in a productive way in our collective spaces. And so with that, I am gonna turn things finally to the panelists, starting with the first question. And that question is, why are you all here? Can you share some experiences that especially shape your outlook on what we're discussing in this session? Anything that's changed how you think about this?
All right, hi everyone. Thank you all for being here. I know this is not the easiest or funnest topic around, but it is, in my opinion, one of the most important. So I'm here for a lot of reasons. I have personal, political, and even professional and academic investments in this question of transformative justice and sexual violence. But the driving force of my investment is in the question of sexual violence and harm inside our movements. The primary and most important reason I'm here is because I love my comrades, past, present, and especially future. I need those comrades, and I want those comrades by my side. And for them to be by my side, I need a left that's safe for us, because I know I need each and, can y'all hear me? It's like, laptops and mics are hard to center. I'm gonna figure it out, I'm an adult. I know that we can't win any of our demands, let alone the world, if I don't have all of my comrades. So that means I need a left that doesn't de facto push out survivors and victims and people that have hurt, and people that have experienced harm, because the people that hurt them have never been held accountable, or their organizations and comrades couldn't find a way to support them. I need a left that knows how to respond when we hurt each other and when we get hurt, and moreover, like, how to hold us the fuck accountable when we hurt each other, right? I need a left that can do all of those things, because I love my comrades and I need them by my side if we're gonna win. I want us to be accountable to our politics and to each other. I want movements and communities that demand our best, foster our best, call us on our shit, and carry us when we fall short, and I want to figure out how to get there. I'm here because I believe in revolution. I believe we can change the world. I believe that revolution only comes when the working class takes power, and that's a working class that has been pitted against each other, that is diverse and complicated and has much to unlearn. If I believe that thing, that the working class can take power, will take power, ought to run the world for itself, then I believe we need all of us. And I have to figure out how to get a world where all of us are there together. So I am shaped personally on a general level by multiple experiences of gendered harm on the left, inside and outside of it. I'm also shaped very specifically, and my thoughts on this question are shaped very specifically by the sexual assault cover-up crisis that led to the collapse of the International Socialist Organization. As Liz has said, I worked as a co-convener of the Survivors Caucus and a member of the crisis leadership team, as well as fielding more complaints that arose as the organization collapsed. And so I learned a lot about organization, about process, about what it means to respond to harm when you have very few resources. That have really shaped how I think about this question, I think about the importance of this question. But that also means that my ideas are still in development, and I'm very lucky to get to talk through this question in this room with these co-panelists. And so I want to preface with that. I will also say that, like, my outlook is shaped by men who are unrepentant, and it is shaped by the exhaustion I feel when I am told that unaccountability is just clumsiness, that that men are well-intentioned instead of unserious about harm, and that their right to a space is assumed while mine is in question. But more importantly, it is shaped by a comrade who has apologized to me in profound ways, without my asking, without expectation, self-motivated to change and committed to process, open to involving me in their accountability process and understanding if I didn't want to be part of it. While this is a rare occurrence, the relief and renewed comradeship I feel with this person fundamentally grounds me in what the power of accountability, honest, genuine, true, and difficult comradeship is, means and looks like, what it looks like when people check their shit and commit to fixing it, and how good it feels to see that happen and to feel those bonds. And I want that latter experience for all of us, the ability to be hurt and to heal and to not let go of our comrades. So yeah, that's why I'm here.
Okay, first, thank you so much, Mariam. That was so bright what I wanted to hear. So that was really amazing. And I also want to just thank everybody for being here. As Mariam said, it's not an easy conversation. And it's like, I think this work is really about holding the complexities of recognizing how much what we're fighting against is also what we're perpetrating, what we're trying to address with one another. And that's just hard to do. And so it requires a willingness to show up for the conversation, and a willingness to reflect for ourselves where we are in relationship to it. And so I appreciate that. And I'm also really appreciative of everyone I'm on this panel with. I don't know anyone. I just am meeting people in the last few weeks as we've talked over what we wanted to do. So I just want to thank them. I am here for many reasons also. I'm here in part because I feel like addressing sexual harassment and assault within our own organizing and left communities is important, urgent, and necessary. I say this as someone who's been involved in organizing, I think, for maybe 40 years now. And so I just am like, wow, here we are. But there's something really different right now because I feel like there's a momentum to try to actually address it in ways that there weren't 40 years ago. So I feel like that's powerful. And it's also powerful to me to say that this issue has always been there. It's not a new issue, and that it will continue to be here. It's not gonna go away. And so what it requires is us to figure out and keep trying out different ways of addressing it in ways that really try to support healing as well as accountability. It's necessary because we lose people. We lose so many people to sexual violence and sexual harassment. It creates deep divisions. It creates hurt and pain, and it undermines organizations, movements, coalitions. It just undermines everything. My own experience began in the late 1970s when I was part of the Socialist Workers Party, and there was a lot of sexual harassment and just general sexism as well as racism, but there was no way of really addressing it. And so when people like myself addressed it, we really just got pushed out. It was like that was a personal issue, we didn't know what we were talking about, you know, etc. And so I was also assaulted by a very well-known leftist professor when I was in graduate school. Also deeply disappointing, to put it mildly. But you know, you're there, you're really excited, you want to learn, and then you get treated in those ways. And then again, feeling just pushed out, right? Because there was no place to really address those issues. And also the lesbian feminist communities that I was part of, anti-violence communities, and realizing there was also sexual harassment and violence there, intimate partner violence, sexual violence by people that I was engaged with and involved with, who also engaged in sexual assault against myself. And so I think it's everywhere. It's not like there's a space that it's not there. And I think that's important to recognize. And then all the stories I've heard over many, many years as a teacher, as an organizer, as somebody who's been really involved in the anti-violence movement. And I just want to share two stories. One is a young woman of color, who's been heavily involved in organizing in Chicago, who recently felt like she had to leave the community because of sexual assault. And it was not only her, but it was several other friends of hers who all had recently started talking to each other to try to support one another. But each left sort of independently and individually, which shows you kind of the way we experience sexual harassment and assault in these organizations is a very isolated experience. It's a very lonely experience, right? And so I thought it was interesting, it was only afterwards, while the person who assaulted her continues to be very prominent in organizing it, even though the organization felt like it had had a process, it was one that left her leaving, right? Her and these other young women leaving. And I also found it interesting that in the last couple weeks, people just seeing me on this program have started, I've been getting emails from people, you know, all over saying, this is happening in the organization, what should we do? You know, or I'm being pushed out of my organization for raising this issue, what should I do? And I'm always like, I don't know, you know? Not that I don't know, I mean, I have some ideas, but I mean, it just shows you kind of the level, the yearning for something to do, and the need. So I just want to say that I'm here also for all the survivors of sexual assault and harassment, which is really huge. Not only those of us who've experienced within movement building, but also outside of it. You know, I think sexual assault, Generation 5, which is an amazing organization out of Oakland, did really powerful work in looking at the impact of sexual violence on organizing itself. Because it impacts people's relationships, it impacts people's trust in one another, it impacts everything, and it's connected to all the power systems that we're also trying to address. I also think it's important to name that it's not only cisgendered women who are survivors of sexual assault, but queer, trans, gender non-binary folks, people with disabilities. And that sexual violence is compounded because of racism and white supremacy and white entitlement and classism and poverty and et cetera. So I think it's, and also men who identify as gay or men who are heterosexual are also survivors of sexual violence. I mean, one of the things I try to think about a lot is if you think about the statistics, you know, one in three women under the age of 18 are impacted by sexual abuse and sexual assault. One in five boys and young men are also impacted by sexual violence and sexual abuse. So I think that's kind of powerful, again, to kind of move outside of just one kind of binary understanding that there are male perpetrators over here and women victims over here, that it's much more complicated than that, and what does that mean in terms of our efforts to try to address it. I also am here, I want to say that because of the leadership and work of women of color and queer, trans and gender non-binary people of color, who've really developed frameworks, ideas, values, strategies, and practices that are really grounded in abolition with a commitment to anti-violence, to really healing and accountability around violence without relying on the state and without relying on punishment and retaliatory violence and banishment. Because I feel like that's where I've learned to really challenge and transform what I would call kind of a carceral approach to anti-violence work. And I just want to name some of those people who I've learned from, because I feel like I don't want the ideas to be attributed to me alone, right? The only way I can say what I say is because of people I've worked with and learned from. So I'm just going to name a very few, but Miriam Kaba, Shira Hassan, Rachel Kaidor, Dina Lewis, who will be on the panel tomorrow on sexual violence in the state, Ana Romero, Ana Mercado, Sarah G. Reed, also Mia Mingus, Ajeris Dixon, Rachel Hersing, Mimi Kim, Alexis Pollingham, among many others. And there's also a whole variety of organizations. I also want to say that I'm here because I really believe that it's possible for us to do this. I really believe it's impossible for people to engage in left, feminist, queer, anti-racist activism and organizing, that we can shift how we respond to the harms, how we can decrease we can reduce the amount of harm that's done between us and within our organizing, and we can find ways to respond to it that are more oriented toward healing and accountability. I believe it's possible and it's necessary, but the only way to do it is to really recognize that it's happening, to be able to name it and to own it and to face it, and then to really sit with that, to figure out, okay, what are the ways out? What are the ways that we can shift this? And that we have to be committed to a reality that there's not one answer, you know, or that it's not going to be there tomorrow, that it's really a process and a set of practices that we have to keep revising over and over as we go along. And so I'll just end with that. So thank you.
Hi, everybody. So to the question of why am I here in this room, actually, I've been asking myself that question all morning. Not sure I came up with the best possible answer, but one real, you know, the kind of answer that my students give me, because it's a required course, I'm here in part because my comrade Elizabeth asked me to be here, and we've known each other for a very long time, since we're much younger people. And so part of why I'm here is because I trust Elizabeth, and if she asked me to do something, probably it would be a good thing for me to do. So that's the first answer as to why I'm here.
Sorry.
That's okay. but I think I have some idea why she asked me to be here. And that is also because in the course of that very long time since I've known Elizabeth and since we each became socialists, Elizabeth first, I've been known, I think, to be somebody who's called out sexual assault, rape, sexual harassment, and chauvinism in organizing spaces that I've been a part of. And so I think it's a double-edged sword kind of fact, but there are many people, I think, who, when they think of the question of rape and sexual assault and chauvinism and sexism in the socialist movement, they think of me. yeah, so I think that's part of why I'm here. But there's a bigger reason, and I think our other speakers spoke to a lot of those bigger reasons why I would say yes to be here in this room. And some of those are related to why I'm here at the socialism conference, which actually, despite knowing Elizabeth for as long as I have, and despite being a socialist for a very long time, this is my first socialism conference. I've really had a great time, actually. I have to say that my relationship with Elizabeth has not been one that is entirely free of conflict for the entire time that we've known each other. And part of why I've never been to a socialism conference is because I just never felt tempted to be at one. I never heard about one and thought, well, that sounded like something I wouldn't be able to read somewhere else or know some, you know, find out somewhere else. And some of that conflict was, you know, sectarian, organizational, socialist type of conflict. And then last year, I saw all your pictures on Facebook about the socialism conference, and I have to tell you, I was extremely jealous. I had a great fear of missing out. I had missed out, clearly, and I decided that I would definitely be at the next socialism. And then in the meantime, the ISO voted to disband itself right after the height of heights, right? Great excitement at the, I thought, really quite historic in terms of the left election of a new leadership in the organization that represented a younger layer of leaders. It represented a a layer of leaders that was more people of color, more women, more queer people, more trans people, and people with better politics. So, and you know, if you had asked me 15 years ago if the leadership of the ISO would ever change, ever, I would have laughed in your face. I would have. And so I was very excited by that, and then of course, sort of riding along with you guys, very, very distressed to find all the subsequent cover-up, all the subsequent damage, selfishness, egotism, that then brought a close, right, to that chapter of sort of excitement and hope. And I was really looking forward to it for y'all, but also for the rest of the socialist left, because we need a revolutionary left that is non-sectarian. We need a revolutionary left that can have conflict over years and develop relationships and develop trust, right, and work with each other, whether we're in the same organization, whether we're in different organizations, whether we're in no organization at all. It has never been the case, and is absolutely not the case now, that there's a single organization that can do the work that's needed to be done to have a revolution. Holy crap. Let alone, you know, like that big job, but all the little jobs, right, involved also in making sure that we have the tools that we need to even contemplate that task, right? And one of those tools is absolutely how we can answer this question of sexism, of chauvinism, of homophobia and transphobia, but expressed as rape inside our organizations, as sexual assault inside of our organizations. And I think especially that's a task that we can't do as a single group. In fact, being a single group, I think, makes that task impossibly harder. And so that is why I am also here with you guys today. I felt a little bit of comradely duty and discipline to do something that's unpleasant. I do not like doing unpleasant things, by the way. It's very difficult to get me to do them, but I will on occasion. And so, yeah, that's my answer. And I guess the last kind of bigger picture out for me is one of the reasons I've continued to be a sort of, some people call it wrecking, some people call it, I don't know what, various things, the way you left this organization, or controversial, courting controversy is another thing that I've heard. Anyway, the reason that I actually continue to do all that is not because I enjoy it at all, and it's not because I want people to send me emails telling me about their sexual assaults and rapes in their own organizations and ask me advice, because I don't think that I do know any great answers more than other people on this panel and more than many other people in this room. But the reason that I keep doing it is because I don't think of it as this kind of natural force that sort of exists in the air and is always everywhere. It certainly is always everywhere, but I don't think that's all that we can say about rape and sexual assault. I think rape is political, and it's political on a grand scale. It's political in the sense that, you know, Mugabe's government went out and raped 30,000 people in the Ndebele parts of Zimbabwe to put down the left of the revolution and to take over, you know, from a right-wing nationalist perspective. Like, that's rape. That's what rape does. But it also is political when we talk about capitalism, right? It's political when we talk about work. There's a reason that, you know, this panel is called Me Too in our movement, right? And there's been quite a lot of resistance, actually, in quarters of the left to the idea that Me Too is political or that it's class politics at all. I'm not here to tell you that it is uncomplicated, right, or that there are no possible critiques of the Me Too movement, but can you tell me when there's been a social movement which Marxists wouldn't have some kind of critique of? Well, that's never happened, right? But one of the things that Me Too does do, right, is that it shows us the ways it's possible, if we think about it, if we think a little more deeply, right, if we look at the strikes against sexual assault and harassment in the hotel industry, right, that I think really are rooted in that moment when Diallo confronted Dominique Strauss-Kahn, one of the most powerful capitalists in the entire world, right? A Haitian immigrant hotel maid, right, confronted her rapist who was Dominique Strauss-Kahn. Now, if you've ever had to do anything like that, I want you to imagine that, because the only people I've ever confronted are like rich little shits on the left, you know, who are like, maybe make a little bit more money than me or have a little bit more social power than me in my organization, right? But it's quite a different gap, right, than what we're talking about there. And she did it in part because she had the backing of her union, HERE, right, which was also full of of immigrant workers and women. And I think we saw that dynamic, right, develop out, right, over the course of Me Too. We saw it happen at McDonald's, right, even in Hollywood. In some ways, actresses, right, are in fact employees, like NFL players, right, they're very well paid employees of very wealthy men, right, and those very wealthy men are rapists, right, and that's what happened in Hollywood, right, and we saw it even take place in sort of less feminized industries, like in auto plants, even in the South, in Tennessee, where the UAW can't win a union to save its fucking life for some reason, okay, but we did see workers in those plants actually standing up against sexual harassment and rape and assault, right, and imagine if the union movement there had, the UAW there had been as responsive, right, to these questions as HERE had been, what might have happened in that union campaign. So when I say that rape is political, to me, it is really part of the material of class repression. It's part of the material force of class repression. It's part of the material force of the condition of class. And the other thing I want to say, when we say it's political, it also means that it's historical. Because one of the problems that I find when we talk about this is that we have this sense, okay, rape is everywhere. It's, you know, you can find it anywhere. It's going to be in the lesbian movement. It's going to be here. It's going to be there. That is all 100% true. But does that mean that we should think of it analytically as something that is unchanging over time? And I want to say that I do not think that is true. I don't think that rape and sexual violence are sort of some primordial soup in which we all swim because we're animals with bodies and all this kind of stuff. And that does get told to you that way. I certainly don't think any of y'all think that. I just want to draw this point out. But in fact, what we see is that the degree, the percentage, the intensity of rape and sexual assault changes as a matter of historical time. It changes in response to feminist movements, to queer movements, and to working class movements, right? It's a reaction to those movements. It's a way of putting down organizing, right? And so I think it's very important for us to think about that when we think about it in the context of our socialist organizations or in our movements, right? We want to think about this as something that has changed in the past and that will change in the future, and that we have some agency to change. So I'm going to leave it there, but that's my sort of why I am here. Existential.
So I'm going to ask our panelists two more questions, and I think we're going to try to move a little faster to get to the discussion portion, but I think this is really helpful for kind of establishing the basic pillars of the discussion here. So the second question that I want to ask everyone is, what frameworks are especially helpful for us and important for us in thinking about these issues, and what frameworks maybe are not so helpful?
So I want to talk about a couple things. First, the idea that no one is disposable. Second, a commitment to abolition. Third, due process ? Yeah, those are my three things. Oh, and also the idea of believing survivors. So those are the four things I'm going to attempt to hit in 5 minutes, so we'll see how this goes. So the first thing is that my driving force in confronting this question, confronting this issue, has been that no one is disposable. Humans have the capacity for change, and we as revolutionaries, radicals, socialists, and leftists have to act like it, and we have to make that change the most possible. Right? Okay, so we're gonna do a little question and answer. How many of y'all idea socialists? Okay, how many of you believe in revolution? Cool. How many of you think that average everyday people, the oppressed, the marginalized, and the exploited, ought to run society for their own benefit? How many of you think we can win? Yes. That was slightly less hands down. That's fine. But so what derives from that series of beliefs held by so many people in the room, right, is that we believe we can transform society, and we believe the working class ought to run society. And we know that all of us have inherited some really, for lack of better language, have inherited some fuck shit from the society we live in. I'm really sorry if someone brought their kids to this session. I'm sorry. But we've inherited some bullshit from the society that we live in. And we all have to unlearn ableism, transphobia, and misogyny, and if we don't do that work, we won't win. And we have to believe that everyone can do that unlearning, otherwise we won't win. And yet knowing that, like, we all know we have to do that on some level, massive swath of this room still believes we can win. That's profound, sit with that. Like, that's actually the project we believe in. And so for us as socialists and radicals and revolutionaries, we actually have to make that change possible. And that means when we are confronted with an instance of harm, right, we can't push people out of our organizations because we don't know how to respond. We can't give bad answers, right, that, or bad processes, right, that survivors and people who've done harm work through. And yet survivors and victims and people who've experienced harm still keep walking out of organizations. That's not enough, because those people are not disposable. Those people are necessary for the revolution we want to build. And we also can't have the opposite response, which is that as soon as a complaint is lodged, the person is lodged against gets kicked to the curb. And that's a harder question for a lot of people in this room, I think. And we have to figure out how to hold both of those people as necessary components of the revolutionary agent in ways that are responsible, in ways that center the person who has been harmed, in ways that demand better, right? So we have to figure out a process of accountability that actually holds us to the standards and the beliefs that we have as revolutionaries. And that's really, really hard, and I don't have answers. But I just want to make that clear, that like the beliefs we all hold and we all share mean that we have set ourselves up for not just like a project of overthrowing the state, which is true, that's also a whole bucket of worms, right, that we gotta do. But like, we've set ourselves a project that means we all have to do this unlearning. We all have been taught by the system that we live in how to hurt each other in profound and scary and terrifying ways. And we have to unlearn that behavior, because we all are people who have likely been hurt, but we are also people who have done harm, and we have to be able to confront that and what that means. And so I think for me, my guiding framework is always no one is disposable, but what does that mean and what does that look like in practice, that no one is disposable. I also think we actually have a complete commitment to abolition, and Anne touched on this briefly, right, that like so much of really brilliant work around this, around this question of sexual violence, around this question of sexual violence and the impact on organizing, comes out of Black feminist abolition work. And we have to be very serious about engaging in that whole field that I think there are huge segments of the left, and especially the socialist left, that has not done that work. I say this as someone who's in the ISO, and I think one of my primary diagnoses of something that happened in the ISO was while we talked about Black feminism, we weren't actually engaging fully in what Black feminism meant and the full breadth of that work. We kind of picked an easy way, which was like finding the few, not the few, but the Black feminist socialists that kind of comported with ideas we already had. But we have to be much more expansive in the kinds of people we're learning from, because a lot of this work is not happening in the places that we as socialists kind of generally look to. So we have to really expand our frame of who we're looking to and thinking through and learning from. And we have to be committed to abolition in a way that means... So I was listening to a podcast called Beyond Prisons. It's really brilliant. Everyone should go listen to it. And I think one of the episodes, I don't know, I've been listening to them at work when I should be doing other things. So they all a little bit blur together in my 8-hour day. Is the idea that the carceral state kind of sits in your mind. It teaches you, it teaches you to think in ways of punishment, and we have to be able to actually unlearn what is like a punishing instinct, and what is an instinct that is about communities of care. So I'm hitting 5 minutes, so I'm gonna throw this last question, kind of lob it at y'all, which is the question of due process. So like Elizabeth mentioned, I'm a law student that is really invested in due process for my clients. It is necessary that we have due process so I can protect my clients from the state. But I think when we import a bourgeois sense of due process into our organizations, we've done ourselves a disservice. And so due process is often a bludgeon that is used to shut down complaints of sexual violence. You see it everywhere, from Fox News to internal documents of the left. It holds a traumatized person's retelling of their trauma up against a series of bureaucratic rules that prioritize often objectivity and neutrality, over truth and solidarity and our political commitments to a world without misogyny. And yet, I think that there is an importance to have process, that we, as we answer this question, still need to be committed to finding truth, holding truth, and understanding truth, and the multitudes of those truths. So the question of due process, I think, is a problematic one. I think it is related to how we understand bourgeois legal rights. It is related to how we understand truth, and it's related to how we view each other. So I think that's a complicated question that I want to kind of let percolate with y'all.
Okay, so kind of from that perspective of a prison abolitionist perspective combined with an anti-violence perspective that's really committed to supporting and caring for those who've been harmed by violence and seeking accountability, that's really the work that I've been learning about and invested in over the since the early 2000s. And it was initiated in part by Insight Women of Color Against Violence, which is an amazing organization that was really looking at the intersections of intimate, interpersonal, and community-based violence with state violence. And they collaborated with Critical Resistance, which is a prison abolition organization. And they developed kind of an amazing framework that I really encourage you to look up. There's a statement online you can find that was the Insight Critical Resistance Statement, where they came together and said, what would it look like if we held both things? If we held a commitment to abolition and to prison abolition, and I think really police abolition, at the same time that we hold deep support and care for those who are harmed by violence. So it's a long statement, but it's very powerful for me in terms of what's a vision of what's possible. That you can really hold, those movements were always seen as oppositional to one another. It was kind of the feminist movement was focused on anti-violence, and the prison abolitionist movement was focused on the state violence and the prisons. And they were often in contradiction to one another because of the way that the anti-violence movement became so institutionalized and sort of co-opted and taken over by kind of a liberal feminist carceral agenda, which is very deeply problematic. But that's what it had turned into, really relying on the state. The state is the only default response that relied on punishment, banishment, but there was also not only highly ineffective in some ways, and only reproduced racism and classism and homophobia and transphobia in other ways. But also, most people never go to that system. That system has not really been an answer. There's no real support, caring, healing, or justice that survivors can find in that system as well. And the system itself is very violent. So what developed out of that kind of analysis that had been building for years, so to start in the 2000s, but were these two concepts, one community accountability and the other transformative justice, that are really deeply interconnected with one another. So I'm going to talk a little bit about community. I'm going to talk a little bit about them. As I said, they're frameworks toward healing, accountability, and justice without relying on punishment or brutality or another form of violence, and that also build accountability. It's not only individual accountability, but collective accountability for the perpetuation of violence, for ongoing harms of oppressive, abusive, and violent behavior and their impact. And there's a number of organizations. I'm just going to give you a couple resources if you're interested in really deepening your understanding. One, Miriam Kaba and another person I'm blanking on their name right now, has a great website called transformharm.org. So I'd really encourage you to check out the resources there. Articles, curriculum, resources, and information on community accountability, transformative justice, carceral feminism, healing justice, etc. It's also connected to some of the organizations, Project NEA, the Young Women's Empowerment Project, BYP 100, Just Practice, Creative Interventions, and others, the Bay Area Transformative Justice Project. These organizations are small organizations that are really, have become sort of spaces of developing ideas and strategies and responding to harm in ongoing ways to try to really practice what these ideas of community accountability and transformative justice might look like. And they're doing them within the context of organizing communities because, at least on the face, there's a commitment to a set of values or a vision for another world. And so it's not the answer to everything, but they're kind of places of practice. One thing that I've really learned from an organization called Just Practice is the idea of practice. Like, instead of searching for like sort of one solution or a template, try things out, take risks, you know, take steps toward really deeply addressing these forms of violence. The practices of community accountability and transformative justice are often creative, organic, they're individualized, it's not about one size fits all, and it's not about a set of policies. I think policies are important, protocols are important within organizations. Does that mean I'm out of time? Okay, finish up. Oh my God. Okay. So I think some key things to me are the question of how do you really build deep support and care for people who've been harmed. Like, if you only did that, that would be a major accomplishment, instead of leaving people so isolated and alone. I think the second is to really build skills. We can talk about accountability, we can talk about intervention into everyday harm, but a lot of us, including myself, don't have the skills. So we have to really recognize that it's a skill. Accountability is a skill, intervention is a skill, and practicing those skills of intervention could really shift things. Skills of intervening in things at the lower level before they get to a larger level. Skills of really drawing people into accountability processes. Learning how to welcome it when people come to you and say, hey, Ann, what you did was really fucked up, you know, or what you did was really racist, or you did not provide support, and me being able to say, thank you for offering me that information. Let me figure out what I've done wrong and how to address it. That's changing cultures of organizations. Instead of always seeing the issues as out there, also seeing ourselves as implicated and involved. And the third thing I would say is really trying to build more practices that really enable organizations to really step up into conflict rather than running away from it. So really, you know, trying to hold the complexity of support as well as accountability simultaneously, exactly what Mariam was talking about, of, you know, kind of refusing a politics of disposability of either side or the multiple sides that are involved in a situation. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
So I'm going to, I think, fundamentally agree but slightly push back on a couple of the things that I've heard on this last few answers. And part of that is because the framework, I think, of community accountability, of restorative justice, is one that I've experienced used in harmful ways in left organizations. I think it's really important to think about that different tools have different sizes, right? Like, sort of just like I don't think a small organization of 800 or 1,000 or 1,200 people is a microcosm of a future revolutionary party, I also don't think it's a microcosm of a future socialist society. And so I am 100% a police and prison abolitionist. I think we should be using restorative justice frameworks in schools now, right, rather than criminalizing young people in schools, and I think that's a really important thing that should happen. I'm less sold on the idea that it is to dispose of somebody to expel them, for example, from a revolutionary organization. Being a member of a revolutionary organization is not a right. It is not a, nobody is entitled to be part of a group that requires a high degree of trust and commitment between its members and a high degree of political unity, both at the level, abstract level and in practice. And you can, there's a lot to be said for expelling people who are dragging down huge sections of your organization, right? And we're saying that in a context of a great number of leftist organizations, sects, however you want to put it, have completely crumbled under the weight of revelations of rape and sexual assault. And I think there's two possible lessons to draw from that. One of those is don't dig into the question of rape or sexual assault, or your organization will fall apart. And I do actually think that's the number one lesson that many people have learned from it. But the other possible lesson, right, is that you have to respond to this stuff early, often, and with transparency, with accountability, with dignity, with as much humility and lack of guile, I think, as you possibly can muster, right? And also to look at, right, I think when we look at each of those organizations or even affinity groups, right, is another place that we've seen this stuff come out. Occupy Wall Street everywhere in the country actually had rape, revelations of rape and sexual assault. And what I noticed at the time was, and actually that was happening very close in time to the events actually that happened here in the ISO as well as into other organizations. So there was this kind of historical moment. That was also around when the SWP in the UK collapsed. So there was some shit going on there, right, at this particular historical moment. And what I noticed at the time was that each of these revelations, or the lack of revelation of them, kind of showed you at a kind of molecular, sort of dropping the dye in the culture, right, to see what the structure of that organization was, right? Less because of who could assault who, but what it took to respond or not respond to that assault showed you how that, the real power structure to power in the organization. Okay, so to get back to the question of the framework, I actually agree with whoever said there's a difference between saying stuff about black Marxist feminism or queer Marxist feminism or black queer Marxist feminism and really deeply engaging, right, in a broad literature and tradition. Those are two very different things, but I also, one of the ways that they can be different, right, is if you are engaging in this in a very shallow level and sort of hold it up as an example, right, of why we shouldn't throw rapists out of our organizations, right, or why we shouldn't, why we shouldn't be focused on healing people who are repeat chauvinists and sexual assaulters and offenders. And I think we want to build a society that will heal people like that, right, because it is true that all of us cause harm, right? But that said, I'm 100% confident I've never raped anybody, and I am confident that I can go forward in my life and not do that. So I do think there's like a difference in that, you know, set of things. So one of the ways it's different, right, is at that level of scale. The other thing about being in a left organization is that you can leave at any time, presumably, right? Unless it's whatever that one was in the basement in Brooklyn. But anyway, don't, like, not to, yeah. But for the most part, right, you can get up and walk out if you don't like the organization. And what that means is that when we try to hold people accountable for very serious actions, right, even actions that are criminal, right, according to the state, people don't want to stick around to be held accountable, and they don't have to, right? Their housing doesn't depend on their revolutionary organization. Their job doesn't depend on it. Sometimes it does. Their social network does. But if their social network is already sort of poisoned by this revelation about their ego is damaged or deflated by their exposure, right? People tend to leave, and they tend to not be accountable, right? So there's a difference between the level of scale and when it's appropriate, I think, to try to involve people in that kind of a process, right? Which isn't to say that there isn't another space for that kind of a process, or that we abandon the principle of restorative justice broadly as a socialist and communist principle. But I don't think we can just apply that anywhere and everywhere to every situation as a kind of way of thinking about the relationship between survivors and victims at all times. So that's one thing I would say about that. The other thing I think is also this question of punishment, because actually I never hear punishment used except as a way of talking about what we don't want to do to people who have harmed other people. And I actually have never really, I've met people who want to get revenge. I've really not met many people who want, and I've met people who want to be safe, right, and just be away from assaulters and rapists. I've never really met anybody who wanted to punish their assaulter or rapist. It's a very weird phrasing, and every time I hear it, my ears kind of prick up, and I think we're already not having the conversation that we need to be having. And so that's one of the ways that, for me, I hold this kind of abolitionist framework and opposition, right, to white carceral boss feminism, right, which we can be opposed to without, I think, having to consider everybody part of our community at all times, regardless of what they've done, right? That's not always, sometimes people do things that make it clear that they are not your comrade or not part of your community. And I also want to recognize that aspect of things in this room.
Thank you everyone for your contributions. And I'm gonna ask our panel to wrap us up with your thoughts on any part of this.
Thank you. I am gonna cry when I say this, but I am just really grateful to be in this room and to like share in what is like the messy project of revolution building with comrades, like the comrades in this room. And so I just like from the bottom of my heart, said I was gonna cry, want to be so grateful for all your contributions and the ways that I have learned in the past hour of listening to y'all. And to listening to the two of you. I'm just like very, very grateful. There are a ton of questions on the table that I could not get to and don't have any answers to, but I just want to shout them out as being things that are really important. I think the question of prevention that Jen and Mary brought up is so central, and I literally could not give an iota of a word of what that looks like, but I think is a question that we have to carry with us until we can find some answers. I also really love what Kate said, right, in this pushback on like a thing I said, right, about no one is disposable. And I think an important distinction in a thing that I didn't get to say earlier is the difference between community and the left. I don't think at any point people should lose their communities when they commit harm. You don't have, like Kate said, a right to the left. You don't get to organize when you hurt everyone around you that's organizing, especially, as Sarah said, when we're organizing around issues of life or death. If we need mass marches to the border, like, I can't have this person that I don't trust that's hurting everyone around them. And on that note, I think this was a common thread throughout the talk and throughout the discussion, right, is that the people that hurt you likely hurt other people.
Yeah.
The people that hurt you probably hurt someone else. And so, briefly, I'm gonna share a personal experience, and then one final thought I had is that, so I experienced this like weird thing of harassment. I still don't totally know how to describe it. When I first moved to LA 2 years ago, I was completely alone. I knew no one in the city, and my first instinct was literally 18 hours off a plane to go to an ISO meeting. That was my instinct. That was like how I knew to organize. That was like, these are my comrades. I'm gonna go find them. That's what you do. And at that meeting, a comrade harassed me and engaged in some weird behavior online and like continued to be weird until it was like a whole shenanigan, right? And I just kind of sat with that discomfort for over a year, kind of stopped organizing for a really long time, and disappeared for a while, but I didn't know how to talk about this thing. I felt very alone. And finally, at the onset of the crisis, which was not about what happened to me, but illuminated my experience. I talked to comrades in my branch about it and found out that this person had already been talked to about their sexist behavior on more than one occasion, right? And it completely changed how I thought about this situation, right? But it was this like isolating experience where like I couldn't talk about it, didn't know who to talk to. But lo and behold, this is a person that had already been talked to multiple times. And this person is like kind of who I was talking about when I said like this person is completely unwilling to be accountable. And that's not a person that like you can organize with, right? Like that is actually a person that is destructive, and we like lose more comrades than we gain by having this person around. So many of my comrades have been lost in Los Angeles because of this person, and like that's not, you can't do anything, you can't win like that. So the last thing I want to say is to answer this question, to deal with the questions in the room. We as revolutionaries have to learn how to walk, talk, chew gum, and build revolution at the same time. We literally have to. There are concentration camps on the border, the planet is dying, and there's sexual violence rampant in our organizations, and we have to solve all of that at once, which is hard. And we have to think about resources, and we have to think about resource allocation, and what does it mean to build cultures, communities, and organizations that can do all of that at once. I don't have answers for you. I wish I did. I wish I could give you a pamphlet that says this is how you do the thing. So what happened to the ISO doesn't happen to you. What happened to me doesn't happen to you. But I don't have that. And instead, we have to figure out what trust is, figure out what trust looks like, and build revolution in ways that are safe and keep us alive. Yeah.
So I just want to echo Miriam's gratitude. I was just so, I just really appreciate all the stories that people told and the questions that people have, because I think these are the questions, and there's probably many more. And that I don't think that, I certainly don't have the answers to those questions, but I really believe in the process of really making the questions part of part of the work of strategizing around. And I think, I really believe that it's important to think about, which is what we're doing, and what I try to do is really gather with others to ask the questions and to figure out different responses to it, and to try out those responses and then keep trying out those, other responses when those don't work, which, it doesn't say everything, but I think that a lot of times we feel like the burden is our own, or that we have to come up with the answer to whatever the question is. And I think that that's not gonna work. I think it can only happen through a collective process. I also thought Sarah's question was so powerful about where is trust and where do we find it. And I really appreciated the, because I think this is what happens when people say, when people come out and say that somebody that we trust and that we care about has committed some kind of harm, it's very hard to take that in. It's very hard, and so I think grappling with that, who do we believe and who do we not believe? Who are we willing to hold, push out of our organization, who are we not willing to? Who do we build our loyalty with, who do we not? And I think those are really important questions, and again, not easy questions. They're not questions, so I think that has to be also at the center of always questioning ourselves and our organizations about how we're responding to people. I also think that the question of prevention and the question is also a central question, and part of that for me is really building our own skills of addressing lower level harms, because I think the problem is that. We're trying to think of really egregious harms, but there's low-level harms that are happening all the time that we're also not addressing that often lead to higher-level problems. And so I think really trying to figure out how to build those skills of addressing those could do a lot toward prevention. Because people know what you can get away with. You know what I mean? People know what you can get, and I think that goes back to the question of organizational cultures, hearing about people who feel like what they bring up, it's completely depoliticized, or people are silenced, or people are not allowed to address power lines that are operating and disrupting the organization. If we can't even name those things, right? And I'm not saying those are always low level, but if we can't name and address the lower levels, there's no way we're going to get to a higher level or the more egregious. And we're not going to be able to create any kind of accountability toward that. And I also, I'll end with just, I think that believing survivors is very important, and I think it has to be supporting survivors. Asking the questions, what do you need? What does justice look like for you? What would you like to see done? And then seeing that as kind of a guide for where we need to go. So thank you.
Okay, so yeah, to echo everybody, I really do appreciate all of you talking about this and being in the room with me and inviting me to also be here with you. So, and I've been very moved, but I'm also gonna tell you deeply affected by listening to all of your stories. I'm in a near dissociation space, so, right. But I do wanna have a couple things that I wanna say about this, which is, a couple things I want to focus on. One, this question of due process and the slogan "Believe Women" or "Believe Survivors," which I prefer, is that I think, obviously, "Believe Survivors," "Believe Women" is a starting place, right? It's not a categorical injunction. It's a slogan, right? And because it's not the case that women can't lie. Women are human beings, right? It's also, you know, lots of shit can happen, right? And women are political beings, right? People are motivated by all kinds of shit. I'm not gonna tell you that it's never the case that a survivor has ever lied about anything. That's like a fantastical, bizarro world conception if we actually think about what history is. But the reason it's a slogan, right, is because knee-jerk, reflexively, and almost universally, right, when somebody comes forward out of a lonely experience, you are not believed, right? And you're signaled that you're not believed, not because people look at you in the face and say, "I don't believe you," or "You're a liar, Kate." They say, "Oh yeah, he's kind of weird." Like, "Oh yeah, he's kind of weird like that," or just shut you down. They don't invite you to continue this conversation more, right? They don't advise, you know, figure out how to support or help you moving forward. They let you know that there's nothing you can do about it, right? And that's completely on you whether you move forward and continue telling somebody else, and often let you know that there will be consequences if you do so, right? And so that's what not believing looks like. That's what we mean when we say believe survivors. I also think it is not actually in contradiction to an idea of a revolutionary due process or even a socialist due process and a socialist organization in capitalism with all its flaws and all our very are actually quite low level of capacity that has to be directed right outwardly. We can't spend all of our time holding tribals for each other in our organizations. But that said, I really do think you have to investigate claims, right? I've had we're gonna talk more about this in the workshop, but like not every claim is the same thing, right? And not every kind of claim is presenting any sort of evidence. Like somebody saying that somebody harmed them in some way, the two people have to have been in the same room at the same time, for example, right? And like that's not, you know, always presented. So I actually fully believe that you have to be able to figure out what the facts of the situation are, and I think there are ways of thinking about doing that. I don't think we should counterpose the idea of believing survivors and due process. And so that's my first thing I want to say about. The second thing is I really like the comment that came up about sharing information, right? So I think broadly, I came out of a tradition that was very sort of opposed to sectarianism in principle. Whether or not that was always the case in practice is another question, but the principle is one I quite like, and I like it because I think it should be possible for us to think about a way that our organizations can hold our organizations accountable in a way that allows us to build in some solidarity, some accountability around questions of rape, sexual assault, but also bullying, also other kinds of harmful behaviors between organizations, right? Because it's often been the case in my experience that there'll be these ad hoc sort of groups of survivors, of women, right, that get together from different organizations, and the fact that you're talking to somebody from another organization kind of frees you up to be able to talk about something that would be much more difficult to talk about in your own organization. There might be a way that we could systematize that, something that I would really like to think about. And the last thing I want to say was this question about trust and denial, and it is difficult to believe that your own comrade would do something that you do trust. I want to push back on something that I think is both true in an experiential sense, and that came out of a lot of these stories, and I think we can overly rely on it. And I want to correct, I think, a statistic that sort of came forward in doing so. So I'll be quick. But the first is that this idea that most rapists are serial rapists, that's not actually true based on the data that I'm familiar with. What's actually true is that most rapists are sort of one-off, sort of opportunist rapists or some other situation like that. But most rapes are committed by serial rapists who rape many, 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 many people. Okay, and so part of our process has to be able to identify the difference between those two people, those two kinds of people. And it's not always, so, and that actually also means not conflating, right? Like somebody being like low level, right? Like also those low level quote unquote activities can be one-off and serial, right? Like there's a way in which like somebody can make a sexist joke. I have made a sexist joke probably today, right? And you know, I didn't do it because I wanted to harm you, I did it because I just fucked up or whatever. But like, I hope that I'm not somebody, you know, who's continuously trying to intimidate people with chauvinism, right? And so those are like two different categories, and that's true of rape and sexual assault. I think we really have to think about looking at those different kinds of categories. And also, the people that are serial rapists often are very smart. They're often capable exactly of figuring out what they can get away with. They're often really charming, often manipulative. Some put themselves in positions of power that make it easier for them to get away with what they're doing. And so I also want to push back on the idea that we can always tell kind of by somebody's body language or by their affect or whatever that who is who. Because I don't think that's true. And it's both true that, yeah, there are these guys, you know, guys that we're thinking of that are like big, huge assholes, and you think, you know, he definitely seems like somebody who could punch his girlfriend in the face, right? But then there are also people, and not all guys, right, who seem like great, wonderful feminists, and you could never imagine doing that, and they do it, right? And so I want to push back also on the idea that we can sort of get a sense of, because we know what rape culture is, who the rapists in the room are, and I don't think that's true. So that's not a very inspiring point to end on, but I want to end on the point that I think we can actually build more formal kinds of solidarity around this question and move beyond a kind of whisper network for sharing information into something that is more formal and could be more accountable as a result, right? And less kind of contingent on who knows who and who can do what for getting justice, for getting accountability, for moving forward on these questions.